Accession number 18268, Reel 2.
Bob, Dare Reel 2. When you were in Normandy, how much contact did you have with civilians?
There was a non-fraternising order on at the time, but we still fraternised with the local people, you know, the farmers that had stayed there and had been overrun, and the local people. And we made quite a few friends. But when we went back into the echelon after, to when we had rehabilitation, rest and things, we weren't really allowed to go into the villages to talk. But eventually, I think that it was lifted, and we managed to get back into Bayeux, which is the big city in Normandy. Had a night or two there, but it was a bit raucous for most of us around there. It was mixed up with nationalities, Americans and whatever, and there were a lot of fighting going on there amongst the Americans. So we came out, and we were quite content to get what we can, wine from the locals, and go back to our bivouacs and tanks and stay there.
What do you mean, fighting amongst Americans?
You don't mind if I'd say it?
Yes.
The Americans, white Americans and black Americans. It really, really went to town. But you see, we'd never seen and known about racism, you see. So we, on one occasion, we took two black Americans with us and took them back to our lorry, and we tipped them around and dropped them off at their situation where they were. And they could never understand, you see. Well,
why did you do that?
They were in a very, very bad situation with the white Americans at the time.
You mean they were being chased?
Yes, being chased, fighting and things like that. I mean, they were outnumbered. But it was just one of those things which we weren't used to, you see. We never knew about it. We never thought about it. We treated everybody equally, you see.
Have these black Americans been injured?
No, not at all, no. But I mean, these two. And they were reluctant to come with us at first, but we managed to get them on. Because, you see, they wondered what was happening, you see, when you get two white men and say, come on, you know. But anyway, they came.
You mean they didn't trust you at first?
They wouldn't do really, because we were white. Because there were quite a few there, you know. But that's just one instance. But we just managed to get them, we dropped them off, and we carried back to our echelon.
Now, can you tell me about the chase through France to the Low Countries? What happened to you then?
I can just remember our unit being put onto low loaders, Diamond T's, and all that for this big dash. They called it the big dash. I think it was 68 kilometres, I think, to go right over to Brussels. And that was really, really some dash. We were loaded onto these low loaders, and they just drove, and it was surprising. There was no opposition. It was great until we got to the outskirts of Brussels, and it was absolutely quiet. You know, it was unbelievable. It was eerie when you come into the suburbs, and we'd heard that the Guards Armour Division had come in from the south, down from Waterloo, you know, to the south. And the Welsh Guards, well, we came in, and it didn't take very long. Everybody came out, they were shouting and waving flags and climbed onto the tanks. It was really, really something, you know. And it went on for ages. We could hardly move. But we eventually got through Brussels. There were a lot of sniping, but we didn't see much because we were with our tanks, you see. And they put us into a place, a huge area. It was nearly dark. And it was called Malines, which was just north of Brussels. And we just bivouacked there. They said it was safe, so we packed up, bivouacked, and got a meal and a wash, or whatever it is. When daylight came, we found we were on the airfield. And there were Dakotas landing within 200 yards of us, you know, bringing supplies in. So it was quite a move, you know.
Were you being given gifts in Brussels?
Oh, yes. Well, they're marvellous. Yes.
What kind of gifts?
Oh, they were mostly wine, champagne, things like that. Nothing substantial, you know, and sometimes you get a round box of cheese and things like that, but a lot of it was wine. And any of the compartments that we had where we kept our shells in the turret, you could get about maybe three bottles of champagne down it, you see. I was very fortunate. I managed to save two and bring them back home with me. But it was very nice.
Were any of the soldiers getting off with the girl?
Oh, I suppose they did later on, you know. I remember, I think it was just the excitement, the furore and things like that. I didn't see much of that really because of the regiment, I mean, they're very strict, you know.
So you're at Malines, what happened then?
Well, we were there for quite some time, and it's a part of my, a gap actually, which a lot of my friends are trying to put through. I've got some information from them, because the next thing that I remember was going through into Holland. And I can just vaguely remember getting out and talking to somebody because they were shouting, and the sergeant was talking to somebody from the turret, and this young lady could speak English. So we stood, and I got out of my hatch, and we had a word, and I asked them where we were, and it was, she said, in Holland. So that must have been beginning of September, or early September, October. I think middle of September, but I'm afraid I can't remember a lot up to then.
Was this the push through to try to get to Arnhem?
Yes, that was it. I know we were halted for quite some time there. And then the piece that comes after then, it was, I remember this push. We'd heard a lot about the from the people, from the other officers and that there was going to be a big do at Arnhem, and we'd have to try and get there. But we have to wait. And we did, and we waited. I can't think of the name of the places, but it was south of that. My friends helped me. We all had a chat together, and I can't say that I was actually on the spot when they were. I've already been back to Holland with three of them.
Yep. Just stick to the things you can remember, I think, would be best.
You mean just going through to Holland?
Yes.
Well, the actual incident, which is my demise more or less, was that we were all shunted up the side of the road waiting for orders to go through the corridor, you know, which was going straight through to Arnhem, the so-called bridge too far. Well, we were stuck on the side of the road. And after, I think it'd be about October then, we were told that we'd have to move. And we'd have to, we branched away from the corridor towards Venray and Overloon, around that area. So we ventured, and we split off from the main column, and we went through there to get towards the river, towards Overloon, and it was absolute hell. We were shelled. There were more than minis. There were some infantry about, but not a lot. But it was a real tank scrap battle. And we lost many, many tanks through Tiger tanks. Because they couldn't cross the river, you see, they were trapped. Well, anyway, the big battle at Overloon was really, really something. And we had a bit of a respite around about October the 11th. And we finished up in a wood. And we bivouacked there for the night after this big bombardment with the shells going over the top. And that's when that story started. We started on the push at October the 12th, around about midday, 12 o'clock. And there was hardly any infantry about. We don't know where they were. And they were East Yorks. Anyway, we kept going. And when we started going up this lane, I come to a T-junction, and the sergeant says, turn left. I mean, there were shells going off all over and machine guns. Turn left to turn right. So I turned right, and I was coming in from the, I think it was the, I can describe the west side, east side of Overloon. But anyway, as I turn right down this bit of a lane, it's just through the hedge. So I went, turned left through the hedge, turned the tank through, and all the rest of the tanks did the same. We all turned at the same time, went through the hedge, went right through into this big, massive open field. And there were woods on the right, further up, and a big wood on the left. And we just drove on this here open land, straight forward, and I think it was direction towards the river, but it was just out of Overloon. And we finished up. First thing I knew, I was in a minefield. I didn't know that until after. But I just drove in, and next minute, the whole tank lifted up into the air. And the sergeant said, Sergeant Garner shouted, "Everybody out, out, out." So what I did then, I managed to get out. The inside was full of flames. The blast had lifted me off and rattled me onto the right-hand side. It was dead quiet, but full of smoke, full of flames, and I managed to get out of my escape hatch on the right-hand side. I dropped down to the floor, looked around, there were no firing at me, so I went to the back of the tank, and I went round to the back, looked down the side, my co-driver's hatch wasn't open, so I went back around to the side, in my side, it was full of smoke, went in, all I could hear was screaming and shouting from the turret. And I pushed the escape hatch, because you can't open it from the outside. I pushed my co-driver's door wide open. And there's a bit of a space where you can get hold of him. I got hold of him, dragged him out, and pushed him and dropped him onto the floor. Then I went back outside of the turret, round the other side. And I picked my co-driver, Johnny Lambert, up, and dragged him along the floor, as near to the tank as I can, because you do that because you're in a minefield. Because your tracks have already been in. So I dragged him to the back and laid him down in the track marks. And as I dragged him back, I could see his left leg was severed below the knee and the right leg just down by the ankle. And as I was pulling him, his foot was being dragged inside his boot, but it had been held on by the seam of his denim. But anyway, I dragged him back to there. Looked up at the tank, there were flames coming out of the turrets and all right the side and everything else. The engine was on fire, underneath was burning. So I got on top of the tank, went to get to the turret, and Sergeant Garner came through the turret, head and shoulders came out, his clothes was on fire. So I stood up, dragged him out, dropped him onto the engine covers in the back, and dropped him onto the floor. And I went down and dragged him into the track beside a Johnny and waited. Other tanks had been hit as well, but some of the tanks hadn't been hit and they started sending smoke down. But I went back to the tank to get in through my hatch again to see if I can help my two comrades, which was Gordon Wright and Bob Selman, to try and help them, you know, to do something. But Sergeant must have been shouting because you can't get in. Well, there were flames absolutely pouring out of the top of the tank and anywhere, any smoke and everything else. And I just couldn't do anything. I went into my own compartment, but I couldn't get in because of flames and smoke and everything else. And the shouting that I heard from the two in the turret, it just stopped. And there was nothing I could do. I just had to go back to the two that I dragged down, my commander and Johnny Lambert. And I dragged them in my tracks as far back as I could because none of the other tanks would come any further because it was in a minefield. I mean, I was walking about and it was a minefield. I mean, I didn't know. All I wanted to do was to get them safely somewhere else. Anyway, I managed to lift them and put them on top of one of the other tanks. And one of them we put in through the other side. The co-driver got out and we shoved him in there because there's a compartment, a space in the back of the driver, be about a foot wide. And we slid him into there, you see, because we couldn't get him on top. And we left him on there and he dropped smoke down and then the tanks reversed back on their own tracks, right back, maybe about 30, 40 yards, reversed and took us back into the woods and then just drove us back into a hospital. But what I remember going back there was that there's no way I could stand up. I don't know why I couldn't stand up. But I lost all the skin off my fingers. They were burned, my clothes were all burnt as well. And somehow reason I couldn't use my left leg. I don't know, I've been walking on it, I couldn't use it. But anyway, they put me on a stretcher, and two of the others put them on a stretcher, but the other two, they took them straight, one of them, Johnny Lambert, they took me straight into the first aid post, which is It looked like a farmhouse or a school. And I was laid on the porch, and when they went to get Sergeant Garner, he came past me and he put his arm out because he saw me there on the stretcher. And he just said to me, he says, "Thanks for getting me out." But he said, "You could never have got the other two out. No way. You couldn't have got them out." He said, "You did your best and thanks." And I've never seen him. Never found out where he lives or anything since then. And I finished up in hospital, and I did about, I think about 2 months in there. It was turned Christmas, 44, before I came out of hospital. And it was just, it was put me down, apart from the superficial wounds that I had, it was put down as battle fatigue, because I'd been going from Normandy all the way up and managed to survive. But it was just one of those things, you know, and there's no way I couldn't speak. Ears were ringing. I was just a mess. And that's where I were in hospital.
So you were struck down?
It was something. They called it battle fatigue. You can call it shell shock in the world. That lasted me right well and truly a few years after when I came back to home, when I came home.
But when you were suffering from the battle fatigue, did you know where you were?
Just vaguely where I was, you know, in Holland. I was in Holland, you know, because a lot of the local people were helping out in the first aid rooms and everything else, you know. But there's nothing, I mean, I know it must have been overload, you know, with the action we were in.
But when you were recovering, did you know...
I remember I was taken back to, what is it? All I can remember being put into an ambulance with the others, and we were taken back a long way back. Where it was, I don't know. But eventually I finished up in a hospital somewhere, and this Harley Street man, I think from London, he was a hypnotist. And I was put in his care for quite a while. And I can remember vividly going up to talk. It was impossible for it to come out. It just wouldn't come till eventually that he got it out. But it was a lot. I finished up with a stutter. But he managed to cure that after a while. I was under him for quite some time.
Do you think the hypnosis did you any good?
Oh, yes. It took everything out of me. I was able to relate everything that happened, you know, in detail as well. But it was marvellous how to be able to, you know, get rid of it and talk about it. But there again, full of remorse, because I couldn't do anything to help the other two, you see. Desperately wanted to get them out.
How did he send you into a state of hypnotic trance?
He was just on the couch or something. He was just talking to me or something, and I remember going to sleep. That's it. But when I came he was saying you can talk. It was very difficult, you know, to talk. Very difficult. But I managed. You know, they put me. I remember now into the hospital. There was nurses with red things on there. I think they were Queen Alexandra, and they did a good job. They did a good job. A lot of therapy from them. Trying to talk, you know, and things. Remember things as well. But I think what it was really is the self-guilt of not being able to help. You know, because they were really good friends. Really good friends. We've been together for such a long time.
What kind of therapy did you get from the Queen Alexandras?
Most of them was, it was based on the theory of relaxation. I think it must have been a sort of a yoga, and which I can do to this day. Relax, you know, really, really relax.
How do you do it?
Well, I sit down. It's very similar to the yoga. I sit on the bed, cross my legs, palms upwards, and then I just start from my toes, and I'm trying to think of nothing. And I went, until eventually I could just go. And I still do that, yes. I just go just like that.
You just drop asleep?
You just drop asleep. It's just like that.
Don't you fall over?
No, but if you sat down, you sort of nod, if you know what I mean, just go like that. But when you come to, it's incredible. It's marvellous. And that's, I think that's held me in good stead. It held me up for a certain amount of time, but when I came back home here, and I was out of the army, and I came out in 1948, I think it was, when I came out. Now, those days, they called it ague, but it was nothing but absolute vibration. And the sweat would pour off my face, nose, and drip down. And that used to go on for ages. And then after a while, I used to get over it, more or less. Basically, they called it shell shock, delayed shell shock. But
so these were symptoms of the battle
fatigue? They were symptoms of it, yes. But I've managed over the years, you know, to sort of conquer it inwardly, to do the best.
Have you fully got over it?
Well, I have, but I've really got over it to an extent that the guilt complex is still there, even though it's not my fault. But I still think that I ought to have made another effort to do it. And that's why I tried to, then when I found out, I mean, even now, I would love to find out if any relations to Sergeant Garner is still alive. I've got his number, it's on there. I've never made any attempt. Bob Silman, he comes from Bristol, one or two attempts of that. But I would love to find out if there's any relations.
So you still feel an irrational guilt about it?
Yes, it's the same as, can I turn the clock back, you know? You know, and you know you do it. But what do you do with a 20-year-old? When you're 20-year-old, you just, I don't know. And on hindsight, when you think about it later on, you know, I wish I'd have done that, and wish I'd done that, but there's no way you could have done. I was told many, many times there's nothing I could have done. I have a letter, which I'll show you if you like, and you can take it. And it's a copy of a letter sent by one of the tank drivers, one of my best friends, that was in the tank behind. And he was behind me when he saw me blow up, but he didn't see me get out. And after, when the fight went over, they pulled back into their echelons to regroup and reorganise. And he went back onto the battlefield itself, to where my tank was, and he walked around shouting my name, and all he found was burnt out tanks and bodies, and he just assumed I was dead. And he went through, and they called him John Collier, he went straight through to Germany, right up until it finished. And he said, I went into many fights, but he said, I have never been in a fight, a tank battle like that at Overloon. And I'll give you the copy if you like, it's here.
Did you ever give any news of what had happened to the men in your tank to any relative?
I've told them about it, you know, about how they died, and they died amongst friends, and that's it. But I could never, never tell them, you know, the circumstances like that. The only people that I know that are Gordon Wright's relations, they live in Sheffield around here, and one sister lives in Newcastle. But I never told Mrs. Wright the horrific nature which it was. Because I would never contact them after I came back home, because when I worked in Sheffield, and the name of Wright used to send me a shiver down my spine, because I didn't know whether I'm talking to a relation or brother or sister of Gordon, you see. Because we already met as soldiers, as such. But it was a bit eerie meeting Mrs. Wright, you know. But I've got the satisfaction to put a mind at ease that he was amongst friends when he died.
Can you repeat to me what you were telling me earlier off the record about how she contacted you?
Well, yes, I can. It was, let me see, it was April 1994, and I was getting ready to go to return with another coach load of veterans to Normandy. And a lot of my friends knew about my situation and what happened, because the veterans, we talked about it amongst ourselves. And on Saturday morning, there was a program about Win Cooper, I think they called him. Anybody that would like to know any requests? So I just rang them up and asked them. And they put a request out, which I asked for. If there's any relations to Gordon Wright, I said his parents were known as John and Jane Wright, and I think it was Shirecliffe. And can they contact me at all? And they said, what were you in? I said, well, I was in a tank that was mined. And I said, these chaps were members of the crew. And I said, I'd like to see if there is any and to take a memento or a wreath back to the beaches. It wasn't the actual spot down there in France where we got blown up. And I think half an hour later, I got a phone call. And the lady on the end said, I'm Mrs. Wright. Well, I mean, I couldn't believe it. I met Mrs. Wright. And I asked if she was the correct Mrs. Wright. You know, she said, yes, Mrs. Wright. I'm the mother of Gordon. Well, Gordon died in 1944. And I thought, well, you know, and she said, yes, she says, I'm 91. She says, I've been waiting many, many years to see if I know, because we were told all sorts. And she said, can you come and see us and meet us? She says, I've got a daughter, I live with my daughter. And she was the six-year-old that Gordon used to write, his sister. And I said, it's unbelievable. So when we contacted Mr. Wayne Cooper at BBC, Sheffield BBC radio station, they arranged for a radio car to go to their house, and we had a reunion, and all the family was there. So they gave me a recording of that, but it was really unbelievable. But when we talk about it later, you know, the letter that she got describing that, it was entirely wrong. But I can imagine an officer having to fill these letters out for all the men that had died. I mean, to remember it in detail wouldn't be possible. But at the time, there were target tanks in the area, you see. But unfortunately, it was a mine. And of course, when they found out about the tank as well, it was quite a story for them.
Can you tell me the story of how the Jackal tank comes to be an overloan museum?
Not exactly, because but I think what it is, it's almost on the exact spot. The museum is in the wood, where the, just aside of the, where this battle took place. The cemetery where these are buried are only about, what, 400 or 500 metres away from where the battle took place, you see.